What's up and welcome all you pet heads out there. This is On Rock, a Petrospective. I'm Lindsay Hall.
And I'm Dave Hall.
And I am feeling refreshed, renewed, dare I say it, revived. How about you, Dave?
I must admit, there's been a revival going on in my life recently. And
did it start with you?
Did it start with me? I think it might have started with the father. I think it might have started with him. So yes, it definitely started with him. So, he did bring a revival, and it's really doing something.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. It's warms my heart. Just in case any of you are wondering, there is no hint of sarcasm or facetiousness right now, guys. Dave and I are being genuine in terms of reflecting on this album for this week's cast. We're feeling kind of good. It's left me feeling pretty good, and that's a good feeling. Certainly, after the turmoil and the roller coaster that was Double Take. And let me point out, and I'll shout out to all you guys out there, Dave. I don't know if you've looked on Facebook and the messages that have come through, but Double Take has its advocates.
We always knew it would, and as we've always said, what we love the most is that everyone has the albums that are near and dear to their heart, and there are people out there. We know there are people out there who Double Take. There is something special about it for them. And we knew we were going to get some feedback in that way. So we really appreciate people putting it out there and saying, hey, this is one of my favorites. And, you know, because we've always said we respect everyone's opinion, and we want everyone to respect each other's opinion, because God has given us each a unique and individual taste. And that's what it's all about. And that's what this podcast has been about.
Couldn't have said it better, mate. That Double Take is something of the past, and well, frankly, so is this album. But as we are progressing along the Petra timeline, Double Take was, I feel like I'm saying this every couple of episodes, but it was the end of an era for Petra. Mm. Notably because it was actually the conclusion of their record contract at that time. I think we speculated a little bit that, you know, the decision to go for, a greatest hits sort of album, or a covers of themselves kind of album. It's the kind of decision that a band makes when you're at the end of your contract and you, quote unquote, owe them one more album. Mm. It's one that you can go in and do. I'm not suggesting that they phoned it in. I'm just saying, it's a safe bet when there has been some friction in the period of that contract, because the reality was, you know, at the beginning, I'm sure any record company would have been thrilled to have Petra come on board and work with them. But over the time of that contract, Petra's sales did not do what everybody was hoping they would do. And that's a tough spot for a producer to be in, for a record company to be in, and for a band to be in.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, we've made this point before, but it all seems to, all this journey that's been happening the last few albums, the changes we've seen, the drop in sales, the feeling that seems to have been associated with the last couple of albums, it really does seem to stem back to one major decision. And that was the decision of Bob Hartman to stop recording and touring. And it seems that decision, and we've spoken to Bob, we interviewed Bob. He talked about the reasons and the rationale for that. And that there's nothing wrong with making that decision, but I think the fans of the band didn't receive the change very well. And as much as Petra tried to change and adapt to this new situation and try to bring some new style and some new sound and some new approaches to the ministry and to the music that they were producing. It did not, I don't believe it was ever received very well by fans. And the impact of that was diminishing sales. The impact of that was a feeling that these last couple of albums that we've reviewed, Double Take, God Fixation, they don't match up to, they don't seem to, in a lot of fans' eyes, and we've already said there are fans of these albums, there are people who love these albums, but to a lot of the Petra fans, these albums didn't match up. And the impact was seen in both sales of the CDs and in ticket sales. Concerts were down. They weren't getting, they weren't selling as many tickets to concerts. Therefore, there was not as many concerts on the tour. And Double Take certainly had the, some of the least numbers of any album that they ever released. So, it had an impact on everyone. And I guess there was a feeling when that contract came to an end, Double Take really felt like not just the end of an era. I think there was a lot of feeling amongst a lot of fans that it was probably the end of the ministry. It was almost like the band's last stand and that's going to be it. And everyone knew that was their last, it was out there that it was the last album in the contract, that they were no longer with Word. And that's the, that may very well be it. I think a lot of fans felt that was it.
And it's, it's, what do you do in those circumstances? I haven't read much about this, and I don't know if it's been reflected on in any of the material that you've read. I can imagine that amongst the band, and certainly amongst the three long-term members there, I can imagine the conversation at some point would have come up, and they would have asked the question, is it time? Is it time for us to put a cap on this whole thing? I don't, that's not gospel, so I don't know for sure, but.
You would have to think that the thought process went through their mind. I'm sure they were considering, especially when you don't have a record contract, the thought must be maybe we just do the occasional concert and it's time to wrap up the full-time level of this ministry. It's certainly would have to have been going through their minds. I'm sure that John and we know that at this point the band, there've been some significant changes following Double Take. Like we know that guys like Pete Order, Lonnie Chapin, they stopped touring with the band. They stopped being a part of this ministry. We don't really have a lot of understanding as to why. We just know that that's sort of it. And probably the end of the contract had a lot to do with it. They're probably looking at going, these are young guys going, where to now? What are we going to do now? We need to secure our, these are professional musicians. They've got to pay the bills. They've got to provide for their family. So I'm sure they were looking at, if we don't know what's happening with Petra, we need to look at what other options are out there. And as a result, we saw guys like Lonnie Chapin went and became a part of Michael Tate's first rock band. Yep. Pete Order went and did some solo stuff. These guys are starting to spread their wings, but they weren't the only ones out there trying new things.
No, that's right. Opportunity came for these guys for a very interesting route, and we've shared the story before, but I love hearing it, Dave. So, Dave, please run us through this connection again that brings us to this point, because I love this whole cycle of creative ministry.
And this story comes in part from the revival video event, video that was produced in line with this album. But in, basically 2000, 2001, we had another band that started to go through some significant changes, and that band was a band very near and dear to an Australian's heart, and that's the Newsboys.
Represent.
When their founding member, their songwriter, their Bob Hartman, guy by the name of Peter Furler, had made the decision to step away from full-time touring and full-time recording with the Newsboys. And as part of that journey, he set up his own record company, a company called Impop. And it was Impop Records that reached out to Petra. And from what Peter Furler has shared on that video and also some other stuff I've read, part of this ties into the association that Newsboys had with Petra, that Petra actually sort of brought the Newsboys to the US. Newsboys had toured with Petra in Australia. They'd been the support act, and Petra had brought them over to the US, and they'd done some support work for Petra in their early days in the US. And it was almost Peter Furler's way of wanting to give back to the band, give back to the ministry of Petra. Was he sort of reached out to Petra and they offered them a 3-album contract.
You just inject at this point in the conversation, looking at the founding of Inpop. One of the things that I love seeing was Peter Furler and his partner in the company, their motivation in general had been amongst their touring and encountering a number of the support acts for Newsboys and for other groups or going to festivals and stuff. They were encountering all these wonderful local Christian bands in different countries, in different states. None of them had record contracts. None of them had management. No one was giving them a shot. And Impop was founded on the principle of wanting to give a shot, give a go and an opportunity to these small-time bands and give them a chance to get a broader audience. And I love that attitude. Petra was in a position where, in business terms, major labels weren't willing to touch them again. You know, that they were seen as a bad investment, to use crass terms. But, you know, the Impop philosophy being what it was a thing about saying, well, that's not what matters. What matters is giving an opportunity to someone who's got a message.
But at the same time, I agree, but at the same time, they still carried a name value, and Impop picking them up, it was seen as a big deal.
Well, that's a big
deal. It was seen as a big deal. Petra weren't the only name band to be signed by Impop. We make it very clear that Peter Furler certainly used his association with his now former band, because Newsboys were also signed to Impop on a short-term basis.
That's right.
And the first couple of albums they did with Michael Tate as the lead singer was under the Impop label. But this idea of being able to give new bands and these unknowns an opportunity, that came from their experience of this unknown Australian band being given a shot, being given an opportunity on the back of recommendations by Petra. And so here was a chance for Peter Furler and this new ministry that he's being a part of, to be able to give back a little to a ministry that gave him his big break in the United States and gave the Newsboys an opportunity to become one of the biggest Christian music groups in the world, is still to this day.
So it's a new home for the band. It's a new season. There's time to relaunch in a way, a chance for a fresh take. And their decision is, and I have a new appreciation of this now, having spoken a bit with Bob Hartman and John Schlitt about their journey through this kind of thing. The decision is made, we're going to go back and do another worship album.
Before we go there, I think we need to hark on the bigger decision that you've almost glossed over there, was that the decision was made to bring Bob back in to record.
Well, I mean, that, yes. Yeah, so Bob, you know, Bob making the choice that he will return to the recording studio for them. Yes, you're right. Not something to gloss over there. Fairly significant inclusion in the whole situation.
Yeah, and I think it I think this was a big key. I do think that I wonder if Petra signing a new contract without Bob perhaps being a part of what was going to happen in studio would have had the same impact. I don't know that it would have with where the band was at. I think it was absolutely vital. It may have even been part of, we don't know. I'm speculating here. It may have maybe even been part of some of the negotiations with the record contract might have been, we think it would be good for Bob to be involved in the recording process again. It's certainly, you know, with the departure of these other band members, I think it was a wise decision for Bob to return to the studio to record. Petra now down to essentially these three core members who have been a part of the band for since 1986. Bob, John Schlitt, Louis Weaver. That is what is essentially left. And I think the decision to have them record together, and they utilize studio musicians for the rest of the recording. And we often highlight here, Bob was only recording in studio. He wasn't touring. He wasn't back touring. He was just recording in studio. They had the tour while they were on tour. They actually hired a guy by the name of Trent Thomason, who toured with the band for the live performances. And it's at this time that a gentleman by the name of Greg Bailey signed on with the band to play live as the bass player. But he wasn't utilized he joined sort of as they finished this recording. Trent Thomason and Greg Bailey joined the band for the live trips, and Bob, John, and Louis were focused on the recording of this album.
So was there any touring associated with this album?
Yeah, they went back on tour. They were out and touring following this album. Certainly for a little while. I don't think it was anywhere near as big as what they've been doing for like the No Doubt and the, you know, God Fixation tours, and certainly were a bit bigger. But certainly more dates than what they did for Double Take.
So in a sense, they're returning to, you could argue they're returning to a safe bet, a safe idea. In one regard, a worship album means a few things. It means the burden of generating new material is not on the band. You can create new songs if you wish. However, there is a multitude of great praise and worship music available to be drawn upon, and
especially in 2001.
Especially in 2001. 2001 was a particularly good season in terms of the contemporary Christian music industry for praise and worship albums. That's what that's what everyone was doing. A cynical person could suggest that this was another decision that was about Petra following the trend. However, as we've discussed before, Petra kind of invented the trend way back in 88. And that album the original Petra Praise has remained one of their most commercially successful and creatively fulfilling ventures. So I don't give any real credence to the cynical view. This is a good bet as a band. It's a good decision. It's a good place for the band to be. And that's before you even step into what I think is actually my reflection upon listening to the album. The most prevalent thing about it is an act of humility by three older, wiser Christian men who are choosing to be a little bit vulnerable and a little bit raw and just allow people into watch them or listen to them as they, as individuals, praise God, have a time of worship among themselves. That's what I feel I'm hearing when I listen to this album.
Mm.
These three men, and look, there are studio musos and there is computer and audio production all over the place, but at its heart, there is that sense of like, well, I feel like these three guys are just doing some time with God right now. And we're kind of privileged as listeners to just listen in on something personal.
I like that. That's really good, because I think it's a really good reflection of what the core of this album is, because when I was listening to it, it's very prevalent. Like they've come back to this foundation, Bob, Louis, John. They've come back to a core element. They've come back to a core sound, and I think the producers have allowed these guys to express themselves and be themselves, because what we get is we get Bob first and foremost. And we'll talk about this as we go through the various songs, but Bob has a distinct style of rock guitar. And the moment, pretty well almost right at the beginning of that first song, you can tell Bob's back. The way he plays the guitar, the sound he brings, it's there. But then what I like is we get some guitar layering. Bob is able to express himself and do some different things while keeping the foundation of the song in place. John is almost the only voice you hear in this whole album, because he does it all pretty well, almost all his own backing vocals. Now there are a couple of times where there's some additional support, but essentially we get different range John. We get John at the low range and at the high range. And I remember talking in both of the previous worship albums about how John, when he brings his low range into these worship songs, it has such a deep, intimate feel of what he's coming to the Lord with. But then to allow himself to support his own voice by doing another range, bringing in his high range, bringing in his power as well, it just layered the songs vocally in an amazing way. And Louis Weaver, my goodness, some of this album has some of Louis's most best individual and technical work I think we've heard probably since This Means War. It's just sensational. The three guys just give it to God and we get to enjoy the product.
Now, having heard all of that and said what I've said, I think I'm landing on a slightly different spot. And if I've got a criticism of this album for me, it's that, and it's not saying that anything that you've said is wrong, but listening to it as a whole again, it sounds like an album that anyone could have made. This sounds like an album that Delirious could have made. It sounds like an album that Sonic Flood could have made. Some of the songs, it sounds like an album that just Vineyard Worship could have recorded at some point in the 90s. There are hints, there are moments of distinctiveness that do shine through in parts of the songs. But as a whole, it feels very, very stripped back, almost like the decision going into each song and each arrangement was, we've got to do this, the version that your local small church could duplicate exactly. That's simplifying the whole thing, but that's where I kind of feel like there's my minor conflict or my inner conflict with this album is that it's beautiful and it's intimate because this feels so, so genuine and raw. And I adore that. I think that's beautiful. So it does create this wonderful, beautiful atmosphere of worship, which fits in very nicely with this era of Christian music. But again, the kind of comments that have been made about the previous few albums, there's something about it that doesn't quite feel like a Petra album. And so that's the weird thing, like in the sound or the rock kind of aspect of what makes Petra Petra, I feel the lack of that throughout this album. What we're getting is more honesty from these three men than I think we're typically used to.
But I wonder if that's a reflection on, I wonder if that's that's the result of the choice to record an album of all worship songs that, you know, they haven't written any of them. I mean, I think one of the hallmarks is
that's a significant
what we know. One of the key things about the songs that Bob Hartman has written all the way back to the debut album has been these amazing guitar riff intros, these really strong lyrical songs with some great instrumental bits in the middle. This is the stock standard. We've seen Petra doing this through the years. But by doing a worship album, a lot of worship songs do not lend themselves to that style of intro, do not lend themselves to that style of approach. And so we're not going to get the Petra experience that we sit here and go, well, why isn't this song album like a Beyond Belief or like a This Means War or like a, you know, More Power to You? Because they've brought a different feel. They're tapping into what is being brought by other people and they're bringing that and making it their own. And so I think there are some musical limitations that get imposed on you by doing that, in that some of the songs don't lend themselves to the traditional Petra sound.
And I appreciate that. But my counterpoint to you on this is that was less of a, that was less prevalent in the recording of the first Petra Praise album. And there were songs there that were ancient choruses regarding these days that still had a real distinctive note of who Petra was. And even Petra Praise 2, the sound was dramatically and drastically different to what they were doing for the first Petra Praise album, but it was still distinctive to what Petra was at that time.
But I think here's where I think we come back to where Christian music had come to by 2001, because by 2001, everyone was doing the worship genre to the point that one of the biggest Christian bands in the world is Delirious.
Mm-hmm.
And Delirious were essentially, and they started out, and they will admit this themselves, they were a worship band. And a lot of the albums, a lot of the songs that they put out in with the thought process that churches should be able to replicate this. And I think that was the thing. A lot of music is now, by 2001, we're now in the time period of the biggest selling albums in the world in Christian music are coming out of Hillsong, are coming out of Vineyard, they're coming out of churches. And you know, guys like Chris Tomlin, Matt Redman, you know, they're the premier Christian artists, solo style, and everything they're producing is replicatable in church. And when you look at the song choices for this album, who's written them, when they were produced, they are being written and produced in this time period where everyone is putting stuff out that can be replicated in church. And so your comment earlier about, well, anyone could have done this, that was the style of 2001. Everyone was doing this and everyone was putting out these albums that you could listen to and you could go to church and you could play it. You didn't need to be a rock musician to be able to play in church what you were hearing on these albums. And I think that brings, you know, it's a reflection of the time. Petra, like we come back to this, this is a reflection of time. Are they the leaders? They were the leaders in bringing this genre to the to its prominence. Now it's the prominent genre, and they are working within, they're operating within this accepted style now. And whether that, you know, what you've shared, what you've suggested, those are fair reflections, but I think we also need to see it in the model of what music is being produced at that time and almost what's expected of an album that's going to be like this.
You're making a fair argument there, Dave. And to add something to that, look, my reflection on this is largely subjective. It's personal. And it's that sense of feeling like I miss that distinctiveness about what Petra is in this album. However, big however in this case, if the trade-off that we're making in them swinging into very like a generic sound for this album to match in with what was happening in the industry, if the trade for that is that it allowed them to relax and worship God in a genuine and vulnerable way and capture that on a record, well, what a gift to us. What a gift.
Absolutely.
And they bring it. So let's get in and reflect a little bit. But I wanted, you said before, and this is a big deal, I think, no songs by Bob Hartman on this album at all.
It may
be the only.
It is the only album that Petra have recorded that Bob did not contribute a song to creatively, writing style. So, but you know, I think when we've got him back recording and what he brings to the table as a guitarist, you know, I don't think it's a bad trade off.
No. No, that's what that's a lot of this in this album. There's a lot of trades that we're getting here.
Well, I guess before we get into the albums, we should, I guess, recognize the other trade off we're getting, because we've got the return of Bob, but sadly, we're saying farewell to someone else.
Well, because, yes, although, I mean, he didn't know it at the time.
No, he didn't know it at the time, but this is the last album that Louis was to be a member of the band. It is the last album that he recorded. We talked about this off air and how much the reality is we do not know a heck of a lot about what happened, but following the recording of this album and probably the tour. A decision was made by John Schlitt to basically advise Louis that he wouldn't be performing and traveling with part of the band anymore. And we really don't have much information out there besides that. It's common knowledge that John the word term used was fired Louis, released him, let him go. We don't really have a lot of an understanding why there was never any reason publicly released. And Louis, to his credit, has never said anything about it, about the reasons why this decision was made. John, when we interviewed John certainly, it was very clear that when Bob had left the touring side of it and John took over a lot of that sort of that business ownership of the band, he took that really seriously. And so every decision he made, it was very clear, it was made in what his opinion was the best interests of the ministry of the band moving forward.
And that's the big thing, that like the ministry coming first in that in that statement.
Yeah. So while we don't have any reason as to, you know, everyone likes to speculate why, and there's been a lot of rumors run out there. And I think the reality is, I don't think, you know, without any real understanding, I don't think it's really fair to talk about any rumors. What we do know is both Louis and John have been involved in work together following Louis being let go from Petra. They've recorded several songs together on independent and other projects, as well as the fact that they've done multiple interviews together and even a couple of reunion concerts. So there's certainly whatever's happened has not affected the ability for them to work together in the future. So there must be enough relationship for them to still enjoy each other's company at conventions and in interviews and things like that. So this is our farewell to Louis for now. And you know, I think, you know, what a way to go out.
Yeah. It's interesting, as you said before, you reflected on This Means War, like the later albums. Whenever it's the final album for a Petra band member, you certainly seem to note that they put in a really, really good performance, a really good effort.
I remember
when
when Mark Kelly, his last recording was This Means War. I remember we talked quite strongly about his individual bass playing on This Means War was really seemed to have gone up a notch. Ronnie Cates did the same thing on No Doubt. There was a lot of really good work by John Lowry on his Wake Up Call. Even John Slick back on More Power to You was just, sorry, Not of This World, was just sensational. So it seems that when each musician is sort of, for whatever reason, they often don't know it's going to be their last album, but a lot of the times the last album that they record on seems to be some of their best work. And that certainly can be said for Louis on this album.
Well, we got a murderer's row of worship writers, you know, represented in this band. We got the big names. We got Matt Redman. We got Chris Tomlin. We got Stuart Townend in there wrapping this business up. And let me say, all the Anglicans in the world, you know, started paying attention to this album because of that. Petra can't be too bad if they're listening to Stuart Townend, folks. Well, here we go. There are some names that I don't recognize. We might hit those as we get to those particular songs. I'll confess, though, Dave, though I'm very familiar with Matt Redman, was not familiar. The only version of Send Revival Start With Me that I have heard is this one by Petra. But a bit of a melancholy way of opening this album.
It certainly starts a little more melancholy. I guess that idea of bringing the worship feel, they start with this level of just keeping it simple, that excuse me, that lower level voice that I spoke about earlier, that really seems, John really seems to have this intimate lower range that just seems to be entering into the presence of God, and they just keeping it simple at the start, and you sit there and you go, okay, you can feel there. I think the concept of the song we're looking at you, God. We're wanting to come to you. We're looking at what you're doing. There's that element of wanting to put the focus on God right at the start of this album. And I think by keeping things simple, they immediately put everyone's eyes on the Father. Mm. This is about God.
Yeah, it is the big thing that I note with this. I actually, my first reflections on listening to it was John's gone too low in his register. John is a high tenor voice, which is great for power ballads. It's great for rock anthems. It makes it very, very difficult. He loses a lot of the power of his voice going so low in his register at the opening of this song. It was almost a criticism I had on my first times listening to the song. When you drop to a lower octave, he loses a lot of the power, almost to the point where it feels like he's struggling to keep in tune. However, the contrast that is made in the second verse when he bumps up an octave, it wakens the song up. And it's this kind of thing of like, we're easing you into this space. We're easing you into this space. Reflect and soak. Be in the presence of God. Now, boom, kick it into high gear.
And that's where...
What a pop in the song.
And that's where Bob resurfaces to me.
Yes, yes.
Because when they take it up the octave, we move from just that simple acoustic guitar that anyone could have been playing to the power chords and the sound and the style of Bob on the lead guitar. And it just hits a new range and really takes this song to a whole nother level. It's like we've got your eyes on God, and now we're going to hit you. Here is God. We want God to revive. And the lyrics of the song are almost prophetic for the band, because it's, you know, we're looking to you, God, and you've made this promise. And if we turn and humble ourselves and look to you, you're going to come and heal our land. And it's almost a prophetic word for the band that we've started this song. We've put our eyes on you, and we want you to turn, and we want you to just come and heal this ministry and let it just rise up again. And the power that comes in that second half of the song, or from the octave change, is just sensational. It just hits you in the face, and really it brings you that sound of Petra.
Yeah. No, I do agree. And it's a great opener, because it is that thing. It's inviting the listener in to like an intimate space. Beginning a good journey. It's an album that's going to take you on a worship journey.
Mm.
The Noise We Make is another one that I wasn't familiar with as a staple of worship in church. Certainly know who Chris Tomlin is. Was this one that you ever did at any of the churches that you were at?
I've never been at a church that had performed or played this song, but I certainly knew this song. I had the Chris Tomlin album that it was from, and it's certainly a song that I was very much aware of.
This is the one that kind of put my mind on that track of we've lost the distinctiveness of Petra in this album, because whilst this possibly has the most notable, the most clear opening guitar riff off the whole album, it's just part of the manuscript for the song. It's what Chris Tomlin wrote for the song. It's what any band does when they do it. So
yes, but it's done with the style and sound of Bob Hartman, and
it's Bob's, it's his sound, it's his guitar sound, But I did listen to other recordings of it, and it's not like he's really recreated exactly what.
But maybe it's a reflection of the choice of a song. They've chosen a song that fits what we expect from Petra. This is, you said, it's sort of the one song that really starts the way we know Petra. And maybe that's a part of the choice that they've done, because to me, this is just bang, here we are, guys. It's almost like a statement of we are back. And even the song, the lyrics of the song, this is the noise we make.
Yeah.
We're here, we're back. Bob, John, Louis, we're back, we're driving and we're pumping this. And Louis's drumming is just so technically good here. He's fast hands, really moving, bouncing off different elements, different drums and parts of the drum. And it just really, like you said, it just drives and it is a real, this is a rock worship song.
Yes, it is.
And John's lyrics bring some real power to it. And I love the layered vocals that are utilized through the song. And I really love the end of the song where John starts singing. I don't know if he's singing in the spirit himself, if he's just adding his own lyrical elements to it, or if it's part of what's originally written, but it just adds another element to it that really just sort of helps drive this song. This is one of my favorite songs on the album.
And you know, rightly so. It's very much in their wheelhouse, very comfortable territory for the band. And as you said, like lyrically, it's another statement, an honest and reflective statement of these guys saying, this is what we do. This is what we've always done. And we're just going to be really blatant and blunt about we're doing it for God. And this is worship to God today. I love that. This is the noise we make with our hearts and with our hands. Great, great lyric. Again, carrying on, though, the journey of the band being reflected in their ordering of the songs. We're revisiting this thing. One of the things that they've always done really well, or usually done really, really well, is order their songs, their set lists for an album. Into Oasis, here is a song that I think is the right kind of worship song for a group of men who I could understand might be feeling tired in life. Might be feeling really weary of the journey that they've been on for a long time. But we have this song of, you know, in a dry and thirsty land, you satisfy my hunger, you feed me from your hand, I will stay here with you. You know, just what a moment to listen to these men just saying, I'm just here, and whatever hurts and pains of the journey of the last 10 years, for right this moment here, I'm staying with you, Jesus.
And what I really like about what they brought to this song musically is it's got a real nice group feel to it. You've got your dual guitars, a little bit of sliding bass at the start. No one's overpowering anything, but it's got a bright, lovely feel to it. It feels like an Oasis. It's not the driving rock song. It's not the soft melody, you know, deep worship. It is almost an Oasis of sound as well as an Oasis in lyrics.
Yes. Yes, it is. It's a beautiful, it's a touching one. Almost as touching is the following song, the Prodigal song. And whilst, you know, I won't focus too much on the title because I don't know that Prodigal is an appropriate term to apply to Petra for their journey. But what I do hear here is, again, I'm I'm only happy when I'm with you and living life the way you show me. And it feels like a coming home kind of song, in the same way that doing a worship album feels like a coming home kind of moment, or Petra.
Yeah, they've come home in multiple ways here. We've got, like you said, a coming home in style. We've got a coming home in the sound that they're trying to produce on the album. We've got a new home in terms of a record label, and we've got someone who's come home to the band in the form of Bob. I think there's a lot of prodigal elements that sort of come together in this album, and then they bring forth this song, every breath I draw from you. But I still find you true, pulling me back to you. I love that line, pulling me back to you.
Yeah.
And to you, I will run, the prodigal son coming back home again to you. Open your arms and into your heart. I'm folded in love again with you. It's just, it's got such an element of that return. And you don't need to be, you don't have to have walked away from God to desire to want to run back into his arms. It's very easy to be walking your journey with God and become a little, you know, just take your eyes off God for a moment. And this song almost has that feel of, we don't want to take our eyes off you in any way. Yeah. The heart of the prodigal is, we're coming back home to you. You're going to open your arms and you're going to wrap us up every time, Father. And that's what it is. And they allow the words of this song to really drive it. We don't have a big intro. The vocals are what bring us straight in.
Yeah.
A softer feel keeps it, you know, keeps a unique atmosphere right throughout. Maybe it even feels a little bit double take-ish in terms of the sound that they're producing in the song. There's a lot more acoustic, double layered acoustic. There's very little variation in the song, which there was some of our big comments on that last album. But I think in this setting, with everything that they produce around it, it works.
Yeah, it absolutely works. Unfortunately, at the risk of being controversial in this moment, I will say here is the spot for me. I do not like the next song.
Oh.
So now that is a reflection on Messrs. Sadler and Hartley, not on Petra. Again, because they're utilizing an arrangement by these guys. But and I'll also cop to, again, a subjective thing here. I'm not much for the trend of taking a classic hymn and reworking the arrangement significantly and then tacking in a new modern chorus. It's a music thing. It's not a spiritual thing. All right. I have no problem with these people spiritually. Like, if that's what they want to do. And I'm sure that there are people across the world who find it enriching and touching and beautiful. I find it jarring, and it's very rarely done in a way that I can engage with. So that's me off my soapbox now. I'm done. I also don't like the use of the vocal filter for the final verse of this version of it. I don't think we're doing, that's not a right decision, producers. Don't put a filter on John Schlitt's voice. It doesn't sound good. That's me. I'm done.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because this was something that was happening a little bit in 2001, and was certainly something that was very prevalent in a lot of Chris Tomlin's album work. And I know this song isn't by Chris Tomlin, but that's where I really noticed it, for that concept for the first time, of taking these traditional hymns and bringing in a new modern chorus or a modern verse or something that's extra and added to it that brings it forward. And I've always felt it was an attempt to take these classic hymns and maybe, I was going to say, make them accessible to a new generation, a generation that, you know, doesn't seem to be wanting to listen to some of these old hymns. And I love, there are some old hymns out there that I absolutely love and adore. But I get the idea of trying to bring a new modern element, but keeping the source base.
Yeah.
And I'm in the opposite camp. I really enjoy this song. I will acknowledge, I'm with you as well. I don't like the vocal filter, and I'll have more to say about this song in a couple of albums' time, because I think the live version they do in Farewell is much better than this version. That's my personal opinion. And we'll talk about that when we get to Farewell. But I do love what I like about this. I think what stands out for me is we really get a little bit of Bob at work. We get our first real distinct guitar solo come out in this song. The double, but not just a guitar solo, we get a double layered guitar solo. He plays, we've got the riff being played on two different guitars with two different elements to it, and almost the same guitar solo being played on two different guitars. And I really like what that's bringing in, the power chords. This song has a Bob Hartman feel to it in terms of the way it's being played on the guitar. And I think that's what I really like about this song more than anything, because it's the first song that we can say, there's the guitar solo. We had our power intro on The Noise We Make, but this is probably the first time we've seen traditional Petra turn up in the middle of a song, as opposed to just an intro. And it's been a while since we've heard this.
I agree. Unfortunately, we're sticking with it for a little bit, and we go from my least favorite on this album to what's possibly my favorite on this album, launching into Jesus, Friend of Sinners. And we're keeping a high energy here.
Oh, yeah.
This is the one where I really resonate with what you're saying about Louis. This is really the first song on the album where it really feels like Louis's getting to do something really interesting, particularly in that opening. He's doing some really interesting stuff in the opening of the song, but he gets to mix it up a lot during the body of the song as well. And it's a good feel. This is one that is a very good fit for Petra, and you know, for John's vocals.
But what he does vocally in the second chorus, the second verse, where he's doing the dual vocals at the different levels, is really cool. It sounds really good, and I just like you said, Louis Weaver's drumming in this song is just a whole nother level. A lot of strong power chords. They allow Louis to shine by not overwhelming him with over the top guitar work. I think that's what I like is each member of Petra is being allowed to shine in a different way, and they're not overpowering each other. It'd be very easy to just turn this into almost a thrash metal song. It would have been so simple for them to just go overboard and drive it too much and lose some of the shine that comes out. But this is a real fun song. I really like it. It's got some simple lyrics, but those in its simplicity is a message that is just, it's there for everyone. It's always been the message of the band. This is a great song because it's the fundamental message of who Petra have been from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. An evangelistic band. We're here to tell you about who Jesus is. This is Jesus. He's the friend of sinners. You know, he's a friend of mine. You know, he brings peace to your life. He loves, his love's never going to let you down. He's the friend that's always going to be there. Like, the lyrics just ramp home over and over again the message that Petra have been proclaiming since 1972.
Absolutely. And, you know, from strength to strength at one level on the album. And it took me a while here. Initially, I didn't like this next one. The first song on the album that I actually did recognize from playing in church, our church played this one, Better Is One Day, arguably in the top five most well-known Matt Redman songs. It's another case where it felt initially like John's, you know, having to maintain such a low range for him, felt like a bit of a detriment. But again, you get a contrast right at the end when he ramps up into the repetition part. But it is also one that, like, songs like this are tailor-made for free worship, as I refer to it, where we're going to take some time to just repeat simple lyrics and repeat simple refrains to just stay in this moment and stay in this space. You know, sometimes it gets old quickly. It doesn't hear. It is a beautiful rendition of this song. It feels a little odd. It's something to get used to because, you know, Matt Redman doing a recording of this song with his sort of very sweet baritone tones and stripped back simple accompaniment is very different to the high production and the you know, the computer effects, the synth work that's been going on for this. And, you know, John Schlitt's very, very distinctive voice. But, you know, a beautiful version.
Yeah, look, they really, from a production point of view, I think I really like that they kept it simple at the beginning. And again, they let the words impact your spirit. It allows you to draw in to the message of the song. And again, they build that one thing Petra are fantastic at is building as a song goes and layering and allowing each section to build off the previous one. And it creates an atmosphere of real worship. It to me, this is real heartfelt worship. And I think I like it when you know, I really feel that John, when he's in that low range, it's this quiet style of John just coming in, and then as he allows himself to go up into the other range, as he starts to free worship later on, I think that really allows that the power of the lyrics to come out there, because he's just sort of taking it to another level and his voice takes it there naturally.
On to another one which I recognized. Yay, Meet With Me. I remember doing this one as well.
I remember playing this one in church.
What I find interesting here is that it's the kind of song I feel like this arrangement by Petra isn't as rock as they could have taken it. And is the song, you know, has the potential to go. They're actually pulling back a little bit from going hard, so to speak, which is an interesting choice. But it's certainly well suited to who they are and what they're doing with this album. Like, you know, it's a good solid kind of
run. But I think by not going too hard, they allowed the technical expertise of Bob to come through a little bit more, because this is the sort of song that could very easily just rely on power chords and just the basic riff that comes with it. But I think this allowed Bob to bring some of himself into this song, and and the little riffs that he's doing throughout the song just bring that personal touch to it. There's a great lead riff in this song. We get a really good lead solo in there that, hearing a Bob lead solo stands out when you're not getting a lot of it through the album. And this one really stood out to me. A real nice one that melded in well with what the style of the song was.
Now you satisfy. We're back to one that I'm not as familiar with, and I'm not familiar with the writers of this one. Peter Gross and Ashley White are the credited writers. But we're at that point of a Petra album where we're bringing it down a bit before our peak finish in the last couple of songs. Bit of a reflective moment. Some beautiful lyrics to this song, You Satisfy. It's very touching.
Yeah, and again, they know how to allow the words of a song to be accentuated. They keep it simple, nice acoustic guitar taking the lead with some electric fills underneath it. Just very, very simple in its style. It allows the words to be accentuated again. And, it puts it back. This song is about seeking God. You are all I seek and all I am. In you, I am complete. My delight is your faithfulness. My desire is, to quench my thirst in you. It's about just pressing into God, and by not overpowering it musically, they allow you as the listening worshiper to press into the presence of God with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now I've got a confession to make about number 10 on this album, Dave. Listening to this recording over the last couple of weeks, I realized that I was singing this song wrong all the years that I was singing it in church. I had the wrong melody for this song. It's what I can sort of say is thank you to John for setting me straight on that. But we want to see Jesus lifted high. This is probably the one that more than anything on the album is the one that I feel like anyone could have recorded this. This is the one where, to me, it feels a bit like, my church band could have recorded it this way. Now that's, I don't want that to be taken too far to the point of it doesn't sound good. Of course it sounds good. It's great. It's Petra. They're pros. They know what they're doing. But this is the one that is very kind of stripped back to just what the worship song is, what the music is. And he's got a chorus working with him here, doesn't he? Or he's at least someone doing backing vocals.
This is one of the songs that you can hear that there are other supporting vocals, that haven't been around for a lot of it. It's a song you certainly, you get a strong bass slide at the end. This is probably the one song that really utilizes the extra musicians. You've got the strong bass slide into it, the additional vocals. You can hear this song certainly utilizes the session musicians and the extra singers. You got a real strong bass slide right at the start. You can hear the bass quite prominently, some supporting keyboard work or programming work that's in there. Each section of the song just has a slightly different feel to it. They do try to bring a little bit of difference to each part of the song. Bob brings a nice little guitar solo, and he also has, for the first time on the album, we get a little bit of guitar work in the outro as well, which we haven't really seen through most of the album. But But, you know, it really is. It's probably the one song that's very clearly, I don't want to use the word relying on, but certainly prominently featuring the supporting team that Petrov used in this album.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a really good way of putting it. And it's interesting. It's almost that thing of each of these praise and worship albums that they've done, a lot of their versions are like, well, you can't replicate exactly what they're doing with this in your church on a Sunday, except there's always like there's one song on each album where you could do exactly what they're doing. If you're looking for a primer and a thing on how do you do this in church, in your church, just do it exactly this way. This is this song on this album. You know, it's interesting little quirk of this little trilogy of worship albums that they put out. But we bring things to a conclusion with the godfather of Christian praise and worship writers, Stuart Townend, the man who unites denominations. You know, it's his stuff is classic enough to appeal to the old traditionalists. It's heartfelt enough to appeal to the Bleeding Heart Pentecostals. And it's simple enough that Baptists can play it. So, I don't know whether it was the kind of, I always wonder about this. Was it like we should choose something from each of, or a couple from, you know, each of the major songwriters of the time, or was it a, you know, these songs speak to us right now? I find How Long to be an interesting choice of the Stuart Townend catalog, but it's a good choice for Petra and what they're doing.
It's got a real to me, it almost has a bit of an anthem feel to it as our final song. There's sort of this crying out of this is as we're concluding this, as we're moving out of this album, you know, it's almost that cry out of don't let this be the end. You know, how long before you drench the barren land? How long before we see righteousness? How long before your name is lifted up? You know, God, we're there. How long before you glorify? We just want to see this go. We want to see this happen. We want to see it move. We want to see you moving in all that we do. It's almost that anthem cry out of the band going, this is their cry at the end of the album. How long, God? How long before we're going to see more people coming to know you? How long before your praise is going to be filling the we're going? It's that almost that sense of we've brought it back, and we want you to continue to infuse everything that we're doing. And as we go out, we've recorded this album, as we go out and start to play this album in live venues, as maybe people play these songs in church or in their cars or whatever, that's going to be the cry out. How long, God, before you're doing these things in the lives of everyone who's hearing?
Yeah. It's an interesting choice. I mean, this is a song written in sort of the best tradition of lament psalms, in that sense of utterly and absolutely worshiping God and acknowledging his sovereignty over all things, but also acknowledging life is tough and circumstances are not what we planned or not what we want, not what we dreamed they would be. I think it's a brave choice, actually. I'm going to revise my statement there. It's a brave choice to end an album on a statement like this. And on a sentiment like this, where it's saying, Because, yes, you're worshiping God and you are acknowledging his greatness. But it's also you're also tapping into the sense of dissatisfaction that you feel with where things have been, with the state of the world, with what you want to be bringing in terms of ministry. That's the big reflection, because, you know, hearing John Schlitt talk in your interview and just repeatedly talking about ministry and impacting people, and I'm like, what's that got to then feel like? And I look at the journeys of pastors that I know who have pastored churches and watched churches in decline over a period of years. And sometimes there's never a recovery. And wondering, like, was there a version of that for John, watching album sales decline? And for him, it's not about, you know, money going down the drain or numbers reducing. Each of the numbers reducing to him is these souls not hearing the word, or, you know, opportunities that are falling away to be impacted by the gospel. I can feel that in this song as well.
Yeah, and it brings us back to the theme of the album, this theme of revival.
This theme of reviving
ministry, reviving hearts. How long? We want to see people changed for you, God. How long do we have to wait? That's a cry for revival in our world. And this song is, you know, we started off with this concept of send revival to the world, Lord. Start with me. We want it to start here in what we do right now in our life. And we finish with this song going, how long do we have to wait to see it in the world around us? Mm-hmm. It's this journey of revival spiritually, from individual to the world. And it's reflected in a revival of sound and in a revival of ministry, through new opportunities and a new approach.
It's a very interesting sort of season for the band. Look, a fascinating journey to see a band go on. And I'm so glad that in general this album was well received, has been well received. Even amongst people who were kind of like, they've been tuning out of what the band's been doing over the past few albums progressively. You get to revival, and whether they feel the same way I do or not, where, you know, it's kind of generic in terms of, you know, it does sound like a lot of the other bands that are doing stuff right now, but that's never a criticism that I hear. And people are like, they like revival as an album. It's clearly something that's had an impact and touched people, and that's wonderful.
Absolutely.
And it opened up the gate to something pretty spectacular as a follower. I mean, let's not mince words about that.
What's to come? In essence, the prophetic heart of this album, the cry of this album, revival. I believe, you know, not just the spiritual cry, but we were talking at the beginning that this is a reflection of the ministry of the band as well. That they're seeking a revival of where things might be going and perhaps what the ministry is doing. Well, the door that it opened up and what happened when they walked through that door, when we get to our next episode and our next album, is just the epitome of what I think it's the epitome of what you would see when revival breaks out. They call for revival in this album, and the next album is revival has broken out, and we see the impact of revival in the hearts of abandoned ministry.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Reserve a lot. I mean, there's a lot we could say about Jekyll and Hyde. I'm going to try and reserve it for them. Yeah, revival, wonderful journey. I'll say revival's like the train of roller coaster cars ascending that first massive crest up to the top to a magnificent height and a wonderful vista. What an ascension. Jekyll and Hyde is going over the top and then embarking on the roller coaster ride after that at full tilt speed, arms in the air, wind whipping past your face. It's something that looking forward to being able to talk about, but
absolutely. Well, before we get there, before we wrap this one up completely, we've got some decisions that need to be made. We didn't do this earlier, but the album cover, the revival album cover, it's a very interesting cover. And I think we've talked before about trying to fit into a theme or whatever. But to me, I look at this album cover and I see, I don't know what those flowers are called, but it's one of those ones that the parts of it are blown off in the wind, and there's that element of the spiritual concept of revival comes from the pouring out of the Holy Spirit, the wind of God, you know. And I think it's actually quite nicely reflected in the cover itself, of that sort of wind brushing a few of the elements of the plant away behind where it's coming from.
Well, I mean, you know, that what you were seeing on the album there, that's how those plants reproduce. Those stalks get caught by the wind and then spread out over a field. They fall into the ground, and those little things take root, become the next dandelion that shoots up, and so on and so forth. It is an image, as a metaphor, that is an image of surrender. So surrender to the elements, acceptance of who you are and where you're at, and the acknowledgement that the end of something or the death of something can still be just the start of powerful work for God, renewal and rebirth and revival. In one regard, you know, I think you can say that out of everything Petra's ever done. But I'm just glad that one of these stalks that went and then took root in the ground grew up into Jekyll and Hyde, because
you know, absolutely.
In terms of a career capper, I'm glad that Petra Revival is not the last album they did.
It's the first step on the last stages of the journey. Yeah.
But I think it's one of the interesting things about doing this podcast, Dave, is that actually, as we discuss things, I'm actually starting to realize how I feel about things and putting things together in my head. So the actual recording is a process of discovery for me. But is this thing, I'm looking at this cover right now, to answer your question, to the point of this, I like this cover. It's nice. But there's an element of looking at this and realizing kind of for the first time, this is a statement of a band that's like, we're okay. If we are heading towards the end, it's okay. We're going to make it the kind of end that God wants. And we surrender to what he's doing and where he's taking us. And if this is it, then, you know, let him carry on the work and whatever we've done to however he can use it. I see that in this album cover. In one regard, this is the most it's the deepest album cover they've ever done. It's the simplest one maybe that they've ever done. Oh, with the exception of the self-titled album cover. But there's some powerful symbolism going on with this album cover. I really, really like it. I really do. It's very touching.
So how powerful does that symbolism hit? If I look at some of the albums that we've looked at before and we've talked about the symbolism that's on there and how impactful it is, we're talking, you know, where does it rank, say, compared to An On Fire?
It's a hard thing because we're returning to this thing of like when you compare two things that are so vastly different. Like you can't critique Star Wars for being a comedy because it's not a comedy. It's a wonderful space adventure movie. You can, you know, On Fire is a symbolic album cover that is carried well because it's all about in your face, aggressive rock in the name of Jesus. Revival is not that. Revival is a surrender and a contentment and a wisdom and a deep wisdom to it. You know, which is I probably couldn't put this above On Fire or This Means War because they're so iconic for the band. And in the end, that's the thing that's still got to come high is that level of, how it captures the band. This is something really honest and beautiful, but, you know, those classic covers are still, they're encapsulating everything the band was about in that era.
So how does it compare then? And I agree with everything you said, and this is where the interesting thing on these rankings come. Where do you see it compared to a Never Say Die or a Back to the Street that have some symbolic elements to it, but maybe are not as impactful as On Fire?
Yeah. So there's a part, the risk of inducing the ire of some people. I might put this above Back to the Street.
And I was thinking the same thing.
I've never, you know, of that era of covers, you know, I've never been that fond of Back to the Street's cover. In a pinch, I'm probably saying I think I would slot Petrol Revival in above there. But a lot of it is because of that. You know, that symbolism.
I think the symbolism of this album, the message and the symbolism that we were just talking about, really bring it to a level. I think Back to the Street had a little bit of symbolic thing there of what they were trying to get back to at the time. But I think there's a real spiritual symbolism in this as well that I think was missing on the Back to the Street cover. And yet we do have that symbolism in the Never Say Die with the cartoon of the battle going on. We've sort of got that. So I think this is a fair spot for it to fall in, which brings it in as the number 9 album cover of our list so far.
Not a bad showing.
Not bad. Now, look, does any song on this album capture your attention enough to bring it into consideration for playlists? I don't think it does, but I want to, you know, you talked about a couple of strong performances in there. Jesus Friend of Sinners and This Is the Noise We Make. There's some strong songs on there, but are they strong enough to break the playlist?
No, they're not. I say strong. I mean, they're strong in the context of this album. They're not strong in the context of Petra's discography.
And I agree with that too, because I mean, we talk these the worship songs. We've heard some good worship songs through the time. We've heard some good versions of worship songs, but in the end, the I guess when we think of Petra playlists, we want to be hearing Petra at its finest, which is normally something written, lyrics and music by Mr. Robert M. Hartman. So I guess our final decision or our final ranking is the overall album ranking. I'm going to ask you, I'm not going to tell you where things sit here and I'm not going to choose a spot. I'm going to ask you where, when you think of our other albums that we've listened to, where it, how you feel maybe its closest comparison is to date. Or maybe I start with this one. This is our third worship album.
Yeah, yeah.
How does it compare to the other two?
Well, I would listen to this over Petra Praise 2.
Mm-hmm.
That's an easy one for me to say. It's a really hard one. I would probably listen to this over Petra Praise the Rock Cries Out. But I don't know if that means that I think this is necessarily better.
Okay.
Petra Praise, the original Petra Praise, rightly captured this wonderful fusion of who Petra was as a rock band and their sound and the contemporary worship songs that were being sung at that era in churches. And look, it launched a genre for Christian music. So I couldn't put Revival ahead of the Rock Cries Out.
And that's fair. So we need to find somewhere in between the two. And I'm gonna start you at, you said it's better than Petra Praise 2, and I agree. So we're gonna start moving up from there and let's see where it sits. Above Petra Praise 2, we have Back to the Street. I personally feel this is a better album than Back to the Street.
I'd listen to this over listening to Back to the Street. Yep.
Okay. No Doubt.
I would listen to this over No Doubt.
Okay. Unseen Power.
Getting a little tougher now. But I would probably pick...
I think this album is a little bit more consistent than Unseen Power was.
Yes, it is. Like Unseen Power has songs that I love. But yeah, I think I would pick this over that.
Never Say Die.
Ooh.
I think this might be where the line gets drawn. Never Say Die. We I remember when we talked back, we had this sensational side A that was up there as just one of the most amazing. And in fact, if it wasn't for a little bit of a wobbly first couple of songs on side B, Never Say Die would probably be up there in the top five of all time. I don't think there's anything on Revival that can really knock, take away from that first side and the last couple of songs of Never Say Die. It really is sort of there's a real big step, I think, between Never Say Die and Unseen Power. And I think Revival is sort of sneaking into the middle of the two. I think it's a bit better than Unseen Power, but I don't think it's got the strength of Resolve. And it might be, this is where we come back to what we were talking about earlier in the album, that this sounds like a lot of worship stuff, a lot of albums that are produced at the time. We don't have all of that strong Petra-ness to them. There's not a lot of strong lead guitar solos, these big lead riffs leading into the songs. And I think that's where this album probably, the heart of this, of Revival and the real prophetic nature of Revival, I think, takes it above some of the missteps that we see in songs, albums like Unseen Power and No Doubt. But I don't think it reaches the level of Never Say Die.
No, I am in agreement with you, Dave.
All right. Well, that actually brings Revival in as the number 11 album of our Petra ranking list, which is probably it's been a long time since we've had an album. You know, it's been since No Doubt that we've had an album really jump up quite a way. But that's a real solid finish for a band that everyone had felt were done. And their start on this new label brings them a real solid album that is nearly a top 10 album all time.
Yeah. No, I agree. It's
I will be very interested to see whether or not our next podcast makes a bigger run than this.
I think there are going to be some impact on the lists with our next episode, possibly except for the album covers list. as much as a kind of dig, I'll talk about my, the minor issues that I have with Jekyll and Hyde's cover next time. Before we sign off this week, knowing who our listeners are generally, I'm sure it is probably no breaking news to you all, but I feel it's important. As the only Petra podcast that I'm aware of, it would be criminal of us to not mention this, because this news has broken in between, like since our last recording and this recording. Petra have announced the 50th anniversary tour. Look, we knew it was coming. Everyone knew it was going to happen, because how couldn't it? There are still some details that are vague. Exactly who is touring and in what iterations there are, has not been made abundantly clear. There is some suggestions that multiple incarnations will sort of operate on this one tour. So Greg X. Vols' classic Petra lineup, which I've always been confused because it's Greg Bailey, right?
Greg Bailey's on the bass now, Greg and Bailey. John Larry's on the keyboards. I don't
get how you call that classic Petra, but anyway.
Well, we'll get to that down the track.
But my point being, the tour has been announced, but what has been clear, and I'm sure in the United States booking is well underway. But what's been made clear, there's no central hub. There's no production company that is sponsoring this and organizing this as a tour. Petra wish to engage with this on their own, but what they currently lack is a tour management organization or a group to shepherd them around. So what they have actually done on their website has been to open up for expressions of interest. If people wish to book them as a part of this tour, get in touch with them. I say this again, not necessarily for our brethren in the United States, but for any Aussies listening at home. And since I know that there are at least a couple of professional Aussie musos who are in bands who listen to this, guys, surely you can find a way to wrangle them over here to Australia once again. You don't want to let this opportunity slide. So if you're in a position to actually make this happen for Australia or any of the countries around the world that might otherwise struggle, please do it. If you're not in a position to make it happen yourself, pester people who can. Write emails and let Petra know how much you want them to come here. Maybe they'll have some contacts that they can draw on personally. I don't know.
And for those of you who are, who might be in a position, around the world who are able to support this tour and help bring them to your area, I just want to throw it out there as well. There's two podcasters down here that if you've got a concert going on and you want to bring a podcast over there to help support it and maybe promote it and maybe interview you and the guys and all that, we would love to have someone help us get to one of those concerts, because it's a long way and a lot of money for a couple of Aussie boys to try and get overseas.
But Dave, as the premier Petra centric podcast on the planet, you know, I think it's kind of incumbent that we accompany the band for the tour.
Like, absolutely.
We should be the press journalist, the journalists covering the tour. It makes, look, Ron Rockstar might have some issue with that. If you're listening, Ron.
Ron is more than happy to take all the photos.
You can take the photos, but yeah. So, but all kidding aside, we would love to see Petra live. We'd love to see them come here to Australia. If you hadn't heard the news, now you know. Get onto Petra's website for updates and new details as they come. If you can book them, you know, let's start seeing what can happen.
Yeah, and we heard when we interviewed Greg talked about the fact that it is imperative. There are things that need to happen to be able to book a band. So it's not just something that any fan can do. You need to have the right understanding of what's required and stuff. So, but we do, if you're out there and you want to be a part of that, you know, reach out to them. And you know, this is a great opportunity for Petra to come back for that 50th tour. And I'm just starting to picture the set list for that tour, for those sorts of events. I think there'd be a lot of songs on our playlist that would be performed.
They should just play our playlist, David. Come on.
You never know. The boys have heard that. Bob and John and Greg, they've all been provided the links, and they know we're out here, and they've heard some of the stuff that we do. Who knows? They might like our playlist as well.
Well,
on that note, guys,
it's about time for us to wrap this one up. Thanks again for joining us at On Rock, a Petrospective. As always, I'm Lindsay Hall.
And I'm Dave Hall.
We will catch you next time.